What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of What's Up With History. My name's Taylor, and in this episode, we're going to be talking about the Golden Age of Pirates. Now, before I get started, like usual, I'll mention my source, which is the book Under the Black Flag, The Romance and the Reality of Life Among the Pirates by David Cordingly. Fantastic book, very easy to read, and extremely informative. The episode that I'm giving to you now is probably a third of all the information that he actually gave us in the book. I just wanted to go over the highlights to make sure that you guys got the interesting stuff. But that's kind of cheating out David Cordingly, because all of the information that he gives us in the book is extremely interesting. And I learned a lot from this. A lot of things that I did not know about pirates in the, 17th and 18th centuries? Yeah. So, without further ado, we'll get right into the topic. So what do you think of when you think of pirates? You think of Treasure Island by Ralph Louis Stevenson. Or Captain Jack Sparrow in the movies Pirates of the Caribbean, or Caribbean, however you want to say it. Now, the book by Ralph Louis Stevenson, Treasure Island, linked pirates with maps, schooners painted black, islands in the Bahamas, and peg legs, and even parrots of colorful feathers. Now, a lot of those tropes are actually very accurate. Capturing birds was popular, especially due to their colors and their ability to speak. The majority of pirates were professional seafarers, which explains their nautical skills and behavior, as in drinking a lot and swearing a lot. Swearing like a sailor, this is where it comes from. Their language contained so many technical terms that it was almost incomprehensible to anybody who worked on land. But they were described as heavily tanned, scarred, and with a rolling gait due to years at the sea, because the rocking of the ocean makes you kind of roll when you walk. There were variations of jackets over checked shirts and baggy trousers with red waistcoats and loose scarves. Others wore more exotic clothes from captured ships, if they were indeed a pirate. But the clothing was pretty consistent between merchants, naval officers, and pirates in general, because pirates came from those two groups, generally speaking. The captains were usually extremely cruel and savage, not just in pirate culture, but even in the Navy. Naval captains were extremely cruel to their sailors and bullied them frequently and even tortured them in some instances. But they were elected by popular vote and could be deposed by pirates. The captains needed to be decisive and skillful, needed to control the crew because it's a bunch of rowdy boys, so you gotta have some semblance of maturity and domineering attitude over them in order to actually keep them controlled. Most pirates were rebellious and lazy. Not lazy in the sense that they were frequently inactive. Lazy in the sense that they chose this life as a means of getting money easily. And they were foul-mouthed, violent drunks who were in league because of shared desire for plunder and the easy life, like I just mentioned. They went to battle heavily armed with several pistols as a precaution because flintlock pistols were notorious for either getting their powder wet and not being able to fire or just breaking in general because they weren't exactly built very reliably. But that was all they had at the time, so might as well carry more than one so you can actually get a shot off. The average age of a pirate, which this will surprise you, in the early 18th century was around 27. These guys weren't old or grizzled older men who had battle scars and were very weathered and aged. They were young guys who were in the service of the Navy or on merchant ships and got forced into piracy or chose to go into it because their captain was so cruel. All pirates were multinational, but most were English and French, and contrary to popular belief, pirates were just as prejudiced as everyone else. People think that Africans on pirate ships were just as free as everybody else and actually were able to take part in a lot of the daily life on a ship, but that's just not true. Black men and women were regarded as commodities on these ships to be sold and used for menial jobs. They treated them as the same spices, silk, and other goods that they robbed from ships in the same regard. Now, the historical basis for pirates, there weren't any aristocratic pirates in the 18th century, but there were in the 17th century. A good example of this is Henry Avery, and hopefully you've heard that name before. He symbolized a typical pirate. He wasn't aristocratic, he wasn't super cruel, and he had a very short career. Avery retired on a fortune, but died actually pretty poor. And another example was Sir Francis Drake, who was known as a sea dog. Sea dog was pretty much just a British privateer, and later I'll explain what a privateer is and the difference between all those terms. He was a patriotic sea dog for Queen Elizabeth I. He plundered every Spanish ship he could possibly find. He was decisive and bold, but respectful in his dealings with enemies. He was the first to fully circumnavigate the globe in his ship, the Golden Hind. Magellan was the first to circumnavigate the globe, according to history, but Sir Francis Drake was the first to survive the trip around the world. Now, the creation of ports that were plundered was because of the conquest of Spain, which began with Christopher Columbus, who discovered the islands of Jamaica and Hispaniola, which were to be major bases for buccaneer raids. Hernan Cortes conquered the Aztecs in Mexico within months of arriving. Francisco Pizarro conquered the Incas in Peru. And the Spanish silver reals and gold escudos, or pieces of eight and doubloons, were popular with pirates because they frequently robbed Spanish ships, because the Spanish were the ones who had access to all the Aztec and Incan gold. And there was a gold train that went all the way from Peru to Central America and then to the Bahamas and out to Spain. So that was going right through where the pirates, Anglo-Saxon pirates, were located in the West Indies. The Venetian ducats were popular with Barbary corsairs in the Mediterranean, and French corsairs alerted the rest of the world to the Spanish treasures in the New World. The first to make a move was Captain Francois Leclerc, or Jambe de Bois. He was called that because of his wooden leg. Sir Francis Drake, learning from his cousin John Hawkins, made his move. He attacked Nombre de Dios, found no treasure, waited for the next fleet, which arrived. While recovering from a bullet to the thigh that really hindered him in the first battle, he failed with a mule train from the Panama City because of one of his crewmates getting drunk and alerting the men who were on the mule train, but he succeeded with his attack on Venta Cruces and the second attempt on the mule train. He got a lot of treasure from this. He also plundered hundreds of thousands from treasure ships on the western coasts of Central and South America. And another good example of a pirate was Henry Morgan, which you've probably heard of Henry Morgan, if not because of the alcohol that is named after him. He was a buccaneer who was knighted and acted as lieutenant governor of Jamaica in his lifetime. So these early 17th century pirates were actually privateers, in a sense. They were very successful, and they weren't hindered in any way. There's no description of his appearance, sadly, so nobody really knows what he looked like, honestly. But he led raids on Portobello, Maracaibo, and Panama, acted as admiral of the Brethren of the Coast, which was a loose group of buccaneers at the time. He sacked Portobello from land and sea in 1668, ransomed the city, one of the most successful campaigns in the 17th century, actually. He attempted to raid Cartagena, but lost a ship in a drunken explosion, which only 10 survived. It was a massive ship that some drunk idiot on his ship lit the reserves of powder and blew the entire thing up while they were in the middle of having a dinner party to plan out this attack. So, of course, losing their flagship, they had to abandon the crusade. Now, a call to the end of the conflict with Spain gave Morgan a chance to climb in status and relax for a bit. As soon as Britain called off all conflict with Spain, he went back home and built up his status, hung out with friends, bought a few plantations, lived a little. Now, a new commission led to an attack on Panama in 1670, which he was called to. He discovers an empty city when he gets there, an empty city that was burned down because the Spanish had caught wind of his incoming attack, and they're thinking, we're not going to leave anything for this guy when he gets here, because that would be embarrassing on their part. So he pillaged the surrounding islands to make up for the loss, and he got actually quite a bit of money out of the area. He was arrested in 1672 for the illegal attack on Panama. He was never imprisoned, and he was knighted by King Charles II, so all in all, he turned out pretty well. He retired to lieutenant governor, caring for his estate and excessive drinking with his friends because he was, in fact, more or less piratical with his habits. And he died on August 25th, 1688. Now, something that wasn't very common, but is very famous, were female pirates. They were very uncommon, but they existed. There was actually a lot of female officers in the Navy and on merchant ships. Females who pretended to be males in order to get on to those ships and serve on them. And nobody ever knew the difference. There's very few actually recorded instances of this happening, but we can tell that it happened frequently in the military and on merchant ships. But in piracy, it was actually pretty rare. The two most notable female pirates were Anne Bonny and Mary Read, which they served under Jack Rackham or Calico Jack. Calico met Anne in New Providence in 1719 and met Mary Read on a captured merchant ship. That just goes to show my example that I made earlier. Now, Captain Woods Rogers, famous pirate hunter, put out a warrant after Calico stole a ship from harbor. The pirates were captured by Captain Jonathan Barnett. Anne and Mary were the only ones to show resistance. So, even though they were female and at this time they were considered not even near enough capable of living this kind of life, they were the only ones that showed some resistance, and they were the most fierce on their ship. So that goes to show. Calico Jack was tried and hung with the rest of the crew and displayed on a gibbet in Deadman's Cay, now Rackham's Cay. Now, if you don't know what a gibbet is, it's just a big upside-down L-shaped post that they would hang people from to display them as a warning to other sailors in the area. Now, Anne and Mary plead pregnancy and were placed in prison. They were, in fact, pregnant. Once they heard that they were going to be sentenced to death, they came out with this information. Mary died of a fever in prison, and Anne disappeared to history. Nobody knows what happened to her. I like to think that she got out and managed to live a normal life afterwards. Women were considered too frail for the sea life and could create conflict on board, aka jealousy between the men, and were actually considered bad luck by most captains. They were prohibited by Article 3 of the Pirate Code, and any sailor who managed to bring a woman on board or snuck a woman on board was actually sentenced to death. It was that bad to them. Women were disguised in the Navy or on merchant ships were surprisingly not uncommon, like I mentioned earlier. But only other historical female pirates were Alwilda, Grace O'Malley, and Mrs. Cheng. But they were decades before this instance. Now, examples of shipwrecks and disasters at sea, the most famous of which is the Wyda Galley, on the shores of Cape Cod in 1717. It was wrecked in a storm, and there were only two survivors, not including the captain, Sam Bellamy. Caribbean and Gulf of Mexico were susceptible to hurricanes all the time, as they are nowadays, so some ships needed to throw provisions or even gear overboard to lighten the vessel. Charles Vane wrecked in a hurricane in 1719 and was stranded on an island, only to be rescued and then brought to justice to be hung. So that's kind of a bad turn of events, in my opinion. Now, most charts were ornate but inaccurate at this time. However, a man by the name of William Dampier, his journals are invaluable on navigational problems at the time and how they solved them. Captains frequently employed local pilots of the ships, but these guys were generally useless, actually. Navigational instruments were frequently plundered from ships that they managed to capture, and pirates' hunting grounds depended on shipping lanes and seasons. Florida Straits of Spanish gold and Windward Passage of merchant goods. Those were the two trade routes that were most popular with pirates in the West Indies. Now, the winter months, they spent most of their time in the Bahamas, where it was warm, and during the warmer months, they spent most of their time along the American East Coast, actually. Now, they also frequented the West Coast of Africa for ivory and slaves. Thomas II even began the Pirate Round, which is a path of trade, illegal trade, between Africa and America. Now, daily life for a pirate was actually very organized, and resembled a lot of other seafaring occupations due to their being their former careers. They were easygoing due to the large population on board. The population on board of a pirate ship was massive, just like a naval ship in the British Navy. Merchant ships, they ranged about maybe 18 to 20 people, but on a pirate ship it could range from 180 to 200 people on one ship, which is a lot of people and gives a lot of guys a lot of free time while others are working. So, they resorted to hard drinking, foul language, and frequent cruelty. The intoxication was the biggest issue, with infrequent gambling, where they gambled away all their money, and that led to conflict between each other. And occasionally ships needed to gather wood and water, frequently. So they needed to careen every few months. And careening is where they would drag their ship ashore, tilt it on its side, clean off all the seaweed and barnacles and other creatures that may be lashed onto the bottom of the ship, caulking it, making sure that there's no leaks, replacing any of the rotting wood frames, and just making sure that it's seaworthy in general. And this happened frequently in the Bahamas specifically because the salt water there and other components really chewed away at the bottom of the ship. But they needed wood and water to get these components, so they made frequent trips ashore and through little inlets and rivers, especially on the American coast. Now, pirate ships were very democratic, as I'm sure you probably have heard. The captain was elected and could be deposed, like I mentioned earlier. The crew chose the target, and all signed the articles determining compensation and punishments. Their motto, no prey, no pay. So the captain had absolute authority only in battle, and the quartermaster acted as a magistrate on ship, as more like a civil magistrate. He was kind of the justice of the peace on the ship. So when it came to disputes, he had the authority. They weren't any officers, but first mates and second mates, and other job titles, such as the cook, the carpenter, things like that. Now, in action, most victims don't resist, and the pirates do not hide their intentions on approach. They show up guns blazing right off the bat. And that usually scares people into submission. So, pirates take their time looting. It could usually take days to get everything off of a ship. There wasn't any rush, since there were only 2 naval sloops and 4 warships in the entire Caribbean, in 1715. Most stolen loot was gear and provisions, treasure was still the goal in most scenarios, and only one pirate ship was really necessary. The most successful pirates ran with 2 or more ships, though, such as Blackbeard or Bartholomew Roberts. Pirates in the Bahamas formed 2 groups, stemming from Captains Hornigold and Lothar and Lowe, Edward Lowe. They teamed together, and these 2 groups kind of created the whole organization in the Bahamas at this time. That's why they were so tight-knit, and they were able to transmit information quickly between each other. And it ensured social conformity, which is why flags changed throughout ships at the same pace. The most popular tactic to catch victims off guard was a fake flag, or ruse de guerre. All pirate flags were simply needed to strike fear in the victims. The Jolly Roger came from either an anglicized Jolly Rouge, which is French for red flag, the Tamil pirate Ali Raja, or the term for the devil, Old Roger. Either one of those seems pretty accurate to me. Maybe all of them are the truth. Now, most pirates didn't really need fake flags to stop ships. They frequent weapons, aside from flintlocks and cutlasses, were grenado shells and broadside guns. Now, broadside guns are what you see in the movies that they fire off the side of the ship, the big cannons that are on carriages, and grenado shells were the early grenades, that stereotypical bomb you see that's a metal casing with a wick sticking out of the top. That's a grenado shell. Now, pirates usually refrain from violence, surprisingly, if the victims surrendered without a fight. The pirates regularly forced skilled men into their ranks out of necessity. Most authors play down pirates' atrocities, however, most pirates use torture only to achieve a goal faster and create a terrifying image. So it was strictly practical, but it was still horrible and maniacal in their way of executing this. Captains and crew could expect no mercy if they resisted. If the captain resisted in any way, he was probably killed or tortured in a severe way. And I won't go into detail about that because a lot of these instances are extremely gruesome. Now, walking the plank was very uncommon, and the only recorded case was on the Dutch ship, the Van Frederica, in 1829. Now, woolding was an easy and common form of torture. Now, woolding is where they would tie ropes on each limb and stretch you apart until you told them the information that they wanted. So it was very painful, but it was very easy for them to do. Now, pirates were in no way the only violent men at this time. England was still executing and torturing people with pressing, which is putting rocks on a person's chest until it either crushes them to death or they give the information that the officers want. And naval captains were notoriously cruel, like I mentioned earlier. Now, the 17th and 18th centuries could be considered just as violent as the Middle Ages, by a lot of means. The most infamous means of execution by pirates was marooning, whether it be a victim or other crew members, guilty of theft or cowardice. Now, marooning gained kind of a romantic image because of the natural allure of islands and the dilemmas man faces, like in Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe, which I'm sure you've heard of. So it's kind of idealized right now. Now, Woods Rogers, the pirate hunter I mentioned earlier, his book also mentions the name by the name of Alexander Selkirk, who actually inspired Robinson Crusoe. Now, regular haunts for pirates at these times was Port Royal, which was a haven for pirates in the 17th century, but that changed after the devastating earthquake in June of 1692. Governors on the island actively encouraged buccaneers, who brought money to the city, and it made a great base for the pirates in the Bahamas, because the more pirates that were there, the more money the city got. Because pirates, they don't bury their treasure, they spend it as soon as they get to port. Now, another haven was the island of Madagascar, off of Africa. Madagascar supposedly housed the mythical pirate kingdom of Libertalia, which is an interesting myth that I recommend you guys look up. But more factually, the ports of Baldridge and Fort Dauphine. Madagascar was also the base for Henry Avery when he captured the Mogul's treasure ship Ganji Sawai and Thomas II's pirate round. The place that he based in Africa was the island of Madagascar. Now, Central American coasts were also frequented by pirates due to logwood trade and Spanish treasure ships. Nassau in the Bahamas became the new base after the buccaneers were driven out of the Bay of Campeche in the coast of South America. And the new pirate ring in Nassau worried the authorities, who notified London, and London selected Captain Woods Rogers for the task of rounding up pirates. Woods Rogers was integral in the end of the reign of the pirates in the West Indies. He offered the king's pardon to all, but death to those who disobeyed it, or turned on it. Pirate executions at Nassau ended pirate security in the New Providence, so that was no longer a base that was secure for them. And Rogers, in his second term as governor of the place, became ill and died on July 15th, 1732, in Nassau. Now, the ships that they chose had to be either seaworthy, fast, and well-armed. All three of those qualities were extremely important to a pirate. Most pirates in the West Indies used single-masted sloops, which were tiny little ships built in Jamaica or Bermuda. Now, Barbary corsairs used galleys with oars manned by slaves, the same kind of things you see in movies about Greeks. Now, the ships needed to be able to weather storms and make long sea voyages because they actually made frequent trips to Africa. Guns were kind of secondary to the seaworthiness aspect since they could be added as the crew population grew. Now, normal practice for pirates was to seize ships and outfit them for service. They were prizes from their plundering. Now, they wanted to open up the lower decks because normally they're strengthened in order to hold cargo, but they wanted to open them up and cut out gun ports so they could put their guns down there, their broadside cannons, and they flushed the upper deck by removing the lifted decks in either the fore and aft, and in order to make kind of an unobstructed fighting platform for them. Now, size mattered with ships. Big ships could survive storms and hold more guns, but small ships were easier to clean and careen, and they were actually faster. Now, pirates were opportunistic with how they attained ships. If they didn't burn it, then they used it. Most attacks were made by sloops in the early 18th century. And sloop is kind of a loose term in these times. Most pirates likely utilized the Bermuda or Jamaican-style sloops, which were the most fast in the West Indies. Now, large ships were known as ships, and small vessels were brigs, brigantines, snows, sloops, and schooners. A lot of famous pirates used ships, with a few sloops or schooners with them in their small little fleet. Now, pirate ships had massive crews, like I mentioned, compared to merchant ships, necessary to outman victims and man guns, because it took at least 4 to 6 people to man one cannon, and it took one person to man these swivel guns on the top decks. So you needed a lot of people to do that, and still keep the ship working. So Blackbeard, for example, commandeered the Queen Anne's Revenge and proceeded to blockade Charleston Harbor with his ship and two other small vessels, which this also happened to be the same year that he fought his last battle with Lieutenant Maynard in 1718. Now, the popular schooner seen in fiction actually appeared a little later in the Golden Age of Pirates. Schooners were popular in books, but ships were more practical for movies, because on the big screen, you need a big ship, because you gotta have a big platform there for them to do cool duels on the ship at the time. So movies in the 20s and 30s were not meant to really be taken seriously at this time. They were more kind of escapist films. And few films follow the events accurately, even though they made a lot of efforts in their production, which is kind of sad, but reality is more fantastic than fiction in these times. Now, another great example of a pirate was Captain Kidd, which I'm sure you may or may have heard of. He's actually most famous because of his buried treasure, and this is one of the few recorded instances of that happening. Burying treasure was actually rare, since most pirates preferred to spend money as soon as they reached port, like I mentioned, and Captain Kidd involuntarily popularized the idea of burying treasure during his trial. Kidd was a great seaman, but was notorious for his temper. He was actually pretty cruel to his crewmates. He was abandoned by his crew in his first naval campaign, but managed to get a new ship from the governor of the island he was stuck on, and sailed to New York, where he got married and settled down for a bit. But he apparently got bored around 1695 and set off on a new campaign to hunt down pirates on the Adventure Galley. Now, Kidd proceeded to play a pirate and seized unnecessary ships and sieged the Laccadive Islands. This kind of defeated the point of his expedition in the first place, which was to round up pirates, because he started playing pirate, which is really counterintuitive in my opinion. He even killed one of his crew members in an argument and drank with known pirates. He switched to a different ship, the Adventure Prize, and learned that he was declared a pirate around this time, and he became desperate and purchased a sloop and headed back to America on the St. Antonio, which was the name of his sloop, and attempted negotiations with one of his business partners, Lord Bellamont. Bellamont, however, arrested Kidd and sent him back to England, where he was placed in Newgate, which is a notorious prison for being very cruel and unclean. He was found guilty, obviously, and hanged, but people hung on the idea of his buried treasure that he claimed to have hid. And so the search has been on for years, and even now, people still look for the treasure. Theory suggested that he used it to buy ships, however, and possibly gave some to his family when he returned home, which, honestly, I believe. And we know more about Kidd's treasure because of the press that his trial got at the time. Now, a second surge of piracy occurred after the Treaty of Utrecht in 1713. The peace treaty decreased the size of the navy and is suggested to be a reason why pirates reappeared, because there's all these sailors who are out of a job, so what are they gonna do, you know? Might as well go pirate if you still want to be a sailor. Because being on a merchant ship was out of the question for some individuals, because the captains were just as cruel as the British naval captains. So, the cruelty of naval captains, like I mentioned, is a supposed influence on their drinking habits. And their drinking habits is another supposed influence on how they turn pirate. But treasure is always going to be up there as the number one reason, because everybody was into finding treasure. Now, Alexander Spotswood, the governor of Virginia, organized the hunt for Blackbeard. This is kind of the first instance of really going after pirates, because he was concerned that the pirates were forming a base on Ocracoke Island, which, if you haven't been to Ocracoke Island or the Graveyard of the Atlantic, beautiful place, and there's a lot of history there that I highly recommend you guys check out. I've been there, and it's amazing. I had a great time. Now, Lieutenant Maynard led the expedition and ambushed Blackbeard. When he came aboard his ship, all of his crew came out from the lower decks and surprised him with how much individuals he actually had on his ship. And Blackbeard lost. This is the battle where he went down with, I think, 5 shots in him and at least 20 different cuts in places. But he was eventually killed by a beheading, and Lieutenant Maynard hung his head from the bowsprit of his ship, which actually wasn't that unsurprising at this time, because, like I mentioned earlier, people were kind of cruel during this time. And his death became a major win for the British authorities and became a legendary battle and was a really big propaganda motive for the British authorities. There were plays in England and tourism and Ocracoke Island, and those really were good business for Britain and America. Now, pirate activity peaked in around 1720, which was soon after this, but not immediately after. There were about 1,500 to 2,000 active pirates in the Caribbean and North America, and coasts and islands were sparsely populated, so this was kind of an issue, because there were way more pirates proportional to the citizens of these actual islands in the West Indies. They were concerned, obviously, so they pleaded with England to send them reinforcements. But there were wars in Europe at the time, which was drawing Britain's attention and efforts, so they didn't have the time or money to send reinforcements to the Americas and West Indies. But eventually, piracy was tackled with new legislation, issuing pardons, increasing naval patrols, and trial and execution. The Act for More Effectual Suppression of Piracy in 1700 ended the need to send pirates to England for trial, so now they could try them where they find them, which removes a lot of paperwork and unnecessary moves in order to finally get rid of pirates, because anything can happen on that voyage between America and England. The pardon, however, was one of the most effective means of curbing piracy. Effective mainly just in the Bahamas, though. It wasn't really used anywhere else in the world. But a substantial reward was placed out to privateers and any other merchant ships for the captured pirates by anyone. And naval squadrons in force were significantly more powerful than any pirates, and they were finally sent out after Britain was done with all the wars that it was dealing with in Europe with the Treaty of Utrecht. So now they actually finally had reinforcements in the West Indies to help them out. But there were a lot of hiding places in the shallow networks on the American coast and the numerous islands in the Caribbean, which offer protection for pirates. There were less hiding spots on the coast of Africa, but there were more diseases, such as malaria, things like that, and local guerrilla forces, which attacked at any random instance and attacked in force. So the second most influential battle against pirates, besides Blackbeard, was with Bartholomew Roberts in 1722, where he was defeated, and this was a big blow because he was one of the most influential pirates at the time. So the third was a battle with Edward Low, and I believe he survived this battle by escaping, but this occurred in 1723, just a year later. The Prize Act of 1692, a few years earlier, helped regulate the now pirate-hunting privateers by making them have to go through the court in Britain in order to actually clarify their goods and give some portion of their proceeds to the British court. And the age of pirates was collapsing surprisingly fast for something that was so effective. Pirates had been hanged at Execution Dock on the Thames for over 400 years, and it was custom to display the bodies after execution on gibbets, like I mentioned, or in those form-fitting cages you always see on woodcuts at the time. And publicity around these trials scared other seamen into being lawful. It was terrifying to sail into the Thames and see all these bodies hanging from the docks. Most trials were short, since there was rarely any defense for these guys. They were pirates, and that was pretty much it. Nobody wanted to stand up for them, because then they would probably be put on trial, too. Now, authorities always wanted to do the aforementioned propaganda, which, the propaganda being the battles that they won, and courts always publicized the evils of the accused, in court and in the newspapers outside. But the final testaments from these pirates before they were executed were always moving, and revealing of the harsh lives that seamen at the time suffered. Now, pirates were terrifying to their victims and continue to occur in developing countries today. Pirates may have participated due to the exotic locations, the romance of the sea, and the anarchic lifestyle. They made their own rules, which is very appealing to anybody who's in an environment where they have no choice, and they're being bullied because of that. Nevertheless, they were cruel, drunken, domineering criminals with short careers. But when you think about it, at the end of the day, we want to believe in the fiction. I mean, it's fun to think about Captain Jack Sparrow or Long John Silver and Treasure Island. Those are very appealing and fun to think about, and those are fond memories from your childhood. So, it's an interesting history full of contradictions, but it was wonderful for me to read about this stuff. It's always a fun topic, and I hope you guys feel like you had a lot of fun with this episode, too. I know it's a little bit longer than usual, because this was a very long book full of a ton of information about such a short period in time. But I really enjoyed taking notes on this and actually making this episode. I hope you all enjoyed listening to it. Be sure to follow me on Instagram and Twitter at JTPepper02. Give me any feedback on how I'm doing, whether you guys want me to do something differently or better, or stop doing it all entirely. And, you know, give me suggestions if you guys want to. But anyways, as always, thank you for listening.